The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
From New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is going to be one of those Think Deeply on Important Issues programs. My guest in the second part of our program will be Professor Frances Fox Piven. And she is a leading progressive voice, and will focus on the urgent need of a united progressive movement to challenge the financial and political forces. A commentary preceding that from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges from TruthDig.com on power concedes nothing without a demand. The latest on earthquake probability. I'll be sharing insights that I have not before, and a study on diet, and the newest on children with ADD and ADHD. Lots of good stuff to share today. No time for calls. We'll be going right to our issues right now. And you can also watch this program. We're streaming live from my studio in New York City on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryKnoll.com. It was 5 years ago that I first premiered my program, The Drugging of Our Children. No television network was willing to air it, not even on cable. What was of particular interest to me is that I sent the program to all the major media players on the left and the right, on Fox, MSNBC. Again, people were not willing to discuss it. And finally, it got up on Google and millions watched it. But unfortunately, to little avail, because there was no major movement to stop the unnecessary drugging of our children, which is most of the drugging of our children. Also at that time, I started a health support group specifically for children who had been diagnosed with learning disabilities, ADD, ADHD, and were on meds. Of course, the children couldn't do anything on their own, but their parents did. And over the next 6 months, we saw some substantial improvements in children's behavior. And therein was the key. There have been no nationally sponsored studies to show what would happen if you radically changed a child's diet, got rid of the soft drinks, caffeinated beverages, the fructose, the sucrose, the artificial sweeteners, got rid of the fried foods and the denatured foods, and instead gave them a wholesome, healthy diet. That study's never been done. We did a small sampling of that. But on an individual basis, all the time, I'm hearing parents say, you know, I started getting my kid off the foods they normally eat, and boy, did I see a difference. I also have had a chance to speak with many, many school teachers that we have in this audience. They've said the same thing. In fact, this past Friday in Newark, at a charter school, the final meeting was held of a four-month study, and the study was for the entire body of all the students, their parents, school teachers, and administration to do the same lifestyle modifications. The head of the school got up to read the results, and they were nothing less than spectacular for those who followed the protocol. Not everyone did, but for those who did, for example, one woman's fasting blood sugar level went from 390 to 115. That's a tremendous drop. And, of course, that gets the person into a safer range. At 390, that person's just waiting for a stroke or heart attack to happen. Now, of course, that's in the first 4 months without medications. People's blood pressure across the board uniformly came down into the safe range where it was high. And several teachers told me that the students who had been following the protocols were much calmer in class, and they lost weight, and were better focused, had more attention and energy. So it was a very productive evening. We filmed it all, fortunately, and we'll edit it and put it into a presentation. My goal is to see that all schools in the United States at least learn what is possible based upon one school that did it. And hopefully we'll get more teachers, principals, parents involved in this process. Here is the latest on this. Study. Diet may help ADHD kids more than drugs. I'll quote this from NPR staff. Hyperactivity, fidgeting, inattention, impulsivity. If your child has one or more of these qualities on a regular basis, he may be told that he or she has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. If so, they'd be among 10% of the children in the United States. Kids with ADHD can be restless and difficult to handle. Many of them are treated with drugs, but a new study says food may be the key. Published in The Lancet, the study suggests that with a very restrictive diet, kids with ADHD could experience a significant reduction in symptoms. Well, isn't it interesting, and this goes back to something that I've suggested on many occasions, when we outside of the official media or official scientific realm, when we discover something and we give the proof, it's given no attention. Years later, they find that diet can make a difference, and they're not even on that much of a restrictive diet based upon what I saw in the study, and they say, wow, news, it makes a difference. This is one of the biggest problems we have in our society today. Those who control power to what gets released to the public. As a result, good information that could change our lives frequently is not given the credibility it deserves. But for those of you who have been following the restrictive diets, you were on the right side of science. Here's something interesting. Scientists at the National Institutes of Health report research into experimental gerontology, which is anti-aging. Here's what it says, and I'll quote this. Acai palm fruit improves survival of flies on a high-fat diet. And the title of the article was Reducing Oxidative Damage is Thought to Be an Effective Anti-Aging Intervention. Well, many of you are taking different types of fruit. You're taking wolfberry and mangosteen and logan fruit. But you're also taking acai. Now, what we have is that now the federal government has done a study and shows that it extends the lifespan, in this case, of these fruit flies, who are commonly used to determine what could impact longevity. Now, they won't do anything with this. It'll just be another one of these studies filed under Experimental Gerontology, Volume 45, page 243. And then one day, you'll ask your doctor, is there any science at all to back up that these fruits are good? No, there's no science. But I heard that this acai was good. No, it's just, you know, it's just nonsense. There's no science. Oh, yes, there is. There's hundreds of thousands of studies supporting healthy lifestyle. Unfortunately, what is the problem? Why aren't we making massive changes? First, because we don't have enough policymakers who are themselves examples of a healthy lifestyle. And secondly, because orthodox medicine, controlled by pharmaceutical interest, block quality independent science from being reported honestly, which would then be the basis of no longer attacking alternative methods as quackery or pseudoscience, but showing it's legitimate. On my program last evening, I had a tape of former President Bill Clinton, how he lost 25 pounds, how he's much healthier, how he's gone on a vegan diet, and why that's important for him. As a policymaker, people will pay attention to what he does. As an opinion leader, someone who works with that information, works him, could move millions of Americans and others around the world in a healthier selection. Unfortunately, in the absence of the dynamic aggressive and the adaptive aggressive that supports a dynamic aggressive, in other words, if you don't have a policymaker and opinion leader, then all the information in the world will not move people to make changes. Olive leaf extract may help hypertension. Quote, olive leaf extract is just as effective in lowering blood pressure as other common medical treatments for hypertension, so says this new clinical trial. And this was published in Phytomedicine. They use 500 milligrams twice a day. I would have used 1,000 milligrams twice a day, but it was good enough to make a substantial difference in the blood pressure. So now, when compared head-to-head with a drug, the nutrient olive leaf extract did as well, without any harmful side effects. And another good thing, yesterday afternoon I went down to try to counsel and motivate an old friend who now has Alzheimer's and trying a healthy lifestyle. Whether or not they choose to do that or not is up to them, but I'm introducing them to Marie McGovern, who has made remarkable improvements, and to be there as a mentor to try to help this person. The son is rather cynical about all this. Well, I'm not so sure. Our doctors would have told us, wouldn't we know, at Columbia University. I says, well, hold on a second. Columbia University is where Marie McGovern was treated. They didn't help her. NYU, Rush Center. They got her to read a little better. They got her up to a three-year-old reading level, like Dick and Jane Go Up the Hill. But they didn't help her beyond that because they refused to look at what is possible. They continue to try to work with what is financially fundable. Here's the latest. Why everyone in the field of cognitive behavior should pay close attention. This is from Nutrition Review. Quote, nutrition of cognition review considers the evidence for Alzheimer's. The new research, DHA, uridine, and choline have improved the cognitive functions. The study assesses previous research and clinical trials that have attempted to use nutritional modification to aid brain functioning. Quote, the rates at which brain neurons form new dendritic spines in these synapses depends upon brain levels of three limiting compounds, uridine, DHA, that's your omega-3 fatty acids, and choline. Hence, oral administration of these compounds can increase brain phosphatidyl levels, unquote. And that's from Professor Wortman, professor of neuropharmacology at MIT. Now, I would say that there are about 13 different nutrients that I would use and do use in helping people improve neurological functioning, but at least they're acknowledging what they wouldn't have just 2 years ago. So when people say, gee whiz, how did that guy that you helped overcome Parkinson's and how that person get rid of multiple sclerosis, Kenny from New Jersey, the plumber? Well, this is how we do it. So now the science, slowly but surely, is catching up. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer. Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer.
Welcome you all over the world who are listening and watching. I'm Gary Noll. In about 15 minutes, we'll be going to my guest, Professor Francis Fox Piven. And earlier today, I was doing some pre-recordings in the studio, and I was talking about what we need in America today is we've had it with the Democrats and Republicans. We've had it with the hardwired liberals and the conservatives. We need a new mindset. But to have that mindset, which is evolving, we need some sense of organization to first just share ideas. Before you can go forward with any change of anything, you have to have concrete ideas that are both reasonable and sustainable. And so I was thinking just to begin something like what could have and was not the Green Tea or Green Party, but a Green Tea Progressive People's Party, where the whole idea is to get people into progressivism, which means positive change that benefits everyone. Now, there are progressive conservatives and there are progressive liberals, but they're not the majority. But taken as a total, independent minds now represent over 42% of the American population and are growing, simply because the standard Democrat Republic off-the-shelf doesn't work. It's just too self-serving, too limited, too rigid, too argumentative, and interested in its own preservation and not in real change. So that's what we're looking to do. So we'll be putting up a place where people can share their ideas, because I believe everyone has something that they can add. The trouble is, historically, when you belong to any movement, you were supposed to accept everything within the movement, the good, bad, the beautiful, and the ugly. And hence, when Bill Clinton was giving away union jobs through NAFTA and bribing, and it was nothing more I said at the time, I wrote and talked about it, look at the hundreds of millions of dollars in pork he's giving to any legislator that won't go along with it to get him on his side. So yeah, he finally got NAFTA and GATT passed, and all the while telling the American unions, we're doing this for you. They were never doing it for the unions. The unions were slaughtered in that, and we're still feeling the repercussions of that. But the Democrats wouldn't stand up and really denounce him, only the progressives within that movement, and then they were marginalized. Oh, you're the far left, the extreme left. So if you really want to tell the truth about what's not working within your own ideology, suddenly you're excluded. You're taken out the door and told, stay out here in the alley. You're no longer allowed at the banquet table. And so that's how it goes. But now there are enough people out in the alley, but they're not working together. There's no cooperation because they've still taken some of the limitations of their original values and belief. All or nothing, you know, right or wrong. This kind of rigidity that doesn't allow you to stop and, as a human being, and say, friend, let me listen to what your ideas are and see if there's anything in what you're going to share that I could agree with. Instead, we have said, well, no, you've got to be the green, or you've got to be the constitutionalist, you've got to be libertarian. Everybody has something they can contribute, and everybody has something that is a limitation. I have found in life, and this is just a general overview of my life and how I interrelate with other people, it is not the best that you are. It is not what you've mastered that allows you to be identified. Even people who do things that are so remarkably unique and great in their performances or what they've achieved that we elevate them to a certain status in our society. That is not ultimately what determines a person's ability to create a sustainable relationship with others. It's your limiting factor. The weakest part of you becomes your most vulnerable part. As a result, it's like in a relationship. If you woke up every morning and smiled and gave your partner a kiss and said, I really like you, and then went out and cheated on him, well, it's not you're saying that in the morning that's going to matter. It's what you did that's wrong. You know, you come to work and you're a great employee, but then you steal. And we just don't accept the idea that we should be going into our dark side and looking at our limitations and what in those limitations could be undermining or limiting our strengths. So as a result, we're terrified of being shown as being vulnerable. Nobody likes to be vulnerable because the moment someone's vulnerable, they're taken advantage of, especially in the hotly contested political and economic and celebrity-based challenges. Just look at the pathetic messes of these reality shows. They're all based upon winning by proving someone else is more dysfunctional than yourself, that they're meaner, angrier, they're more loathsome than you. So we end up rushing to the bottom morally, intellectually, spiritually, and then trying to make the one-eyed man king in the land of the blind. To me, it's just a very disheartening way. I believe that we now must acknowledge our individual biases, our individual limitations, and at least have the strength of character not to engage them. And then say, all right, now that allows me the freedom to see what works and doesn't work honestly and separate out the myth of my story from the reality of my life. Do I really want help, and if so, for everyone, or just me, or my tribe, or my group, or guild? Do I really want prosperity only for my group and me, or for everyone? And only when you're honest in those introspective moments can you see whether or not you're still living a myth that's a conditioned response to your upbringing and what has benefited you up to that point. So that's why I believe it's time now to have a really progressive movement based upon ideals and ideas that can help everyone in a positive way, including the environment. So that's where we're beginning on this. Now, joining us in studio is Jason, and we're going to do a commentary shortly, and my guest is standing by, but I wanted the guest to hear the commentary.
Good afternoon, Gary. How are you? Well, we had a lot of emails, a lot of phone calls this weekend regarding the devastation in Japan, and everyone would like to hear what you have to say and your point of view on it.
There's nothing I can say that's new today. They would have to go back 3 years ago and listen to a one-week special I did on the 12 tipping points. As many of the people in this audience know, I've been filming not just my new film on Poverty, Inc., or on Greed Street, based on Wall Street, or Death by Medicine, but also one called The 12 Tipping Points. And at that time, I went outside of Columbia University Graduate School, and I stopped 100 students and faculty exiting during lunchtime, and I said, could you name the 12 tipping points? No one got three of them. No one. Most only said global warming. That's the only one they knew. And during that series that week, when I went through each of the 12 tipping points, I said some of these tipping points will tip. There's nothing we will do that will stop them from tipping. It is to learn the lesson of what happens when a society has been so negligent that then they're forced to acknowledge the problem. For example, I said, now I'm on KPFK, our sister station in Los Angeles, for 25 years every week for 6 hours on Wednesday morning. And I cannot tell you how many times I've said, you're living right in the big quake zone. You are going to be impacted. It's not will it happen, it's just a matter of when. And 20 years ago, the best experts in the field said that it would probably be within the next 20 to 23 years. So we're right there now. Right now. Also, they didn't take a look at the ring of fire that goes around the Pacific. And if you look at the ring of fire, you'll look at Chile. That was last year. A big quake. New Zealand, just shortly ago. And now Japan. Well, it's inevitable that there will be other quakes, because you cannot have a quake of this magnitude, now it's 9 on the Richter scale, not 8.9, and not have it impact other tectonic plates. The Russians' Institute of Physics have already stated that the West Coast is extremely vulnerable, and there's almost a definite probability that there will be other quakes with a magnitude of 7.3 in or higher in the next 14 days. When I was out in California and I wanted to do the film, I wanted to see how people are living and what their views were. Too many people and not enough water. Most of the water has to come from a 400-mile 1930s public work project that brought in a canal water down from the Sierra Madres, also coming from the Colorado. There's been a lack of snowfall. You can't tell it by this year. You can't use 1 year. But global warming also creates the coldest days, the most snow, and the hottest summers and drought. It creates extremes, but still do the same thing. You also have, so you have too many people living in an area that's not sustainable. You also have people who are living in areas that are extremely wooded because it's preferred property. And yet the moment that you go into a burn area, all those homes are vulnerable. And that's also true, by the way, I was up in Flagstaff. And everywhere I went in Flagstaff, in the mountains, you saw smoke. And because in all those, you're talking about 9,000, 10,000 feet up. Now, normally the people in Phoenix go to Flagstaff in the summer, so to cool off and have their summer homes there. Those are all susceptible to fire. The largest aquifer in the United States is under Kansas, Indiana, Illinois, South Dakota, part of Texas, and it's going dry. Too much water coming out. You have Dubai built, magnificent city. The architecture is spectacular, but it's built on sand at sea level. And it's inevitable that all of Dubai will become a ghost town, broken to pieces by arrogance and hubris of people thinking that just because they can build it and have the money to and resources and ingenuity and creativity, that somehow nature will acknowledge that and not have its own rules. So that is all going to be gone, I predict, within 5 years. You have over 65 million Americans living within 50 miles of the ocean, and many of them living like in the Chesapeake area. In Washington, D.C., that when global warming gets accelerated, as will happen with the melting of the Arctic ice and with the warming of the water, Greenland is melting at an accelerated rate beyond mathematical models. It's in chaos theory. South Antarctica has two large glaciers, one the size of France, the other size of Spain. They're breaking off and melting at a faster rate than anyone had predicted. You take all these, you're seeing a rise in sea level, you're seeing a warming of the oceans, and you're seeing chaos starting to occur. We used to think it was unusual to have the hottest day in the world, or the coldest day in the world, or the most snow. Now we think that that's just normal. You know, one day you hear about flooding, where there's never been flooding. And then you hear about more hurricanes, more tornadoes, earthquakes. And we began to accept this as a normal process. Boy, when catastrophe becomes normal, then we have stepped over that line into pure delusional thinking. I believe that what we should do now is understand how serious all of these 12 tipping points are and do programs worldwide on the 12 tipping points and start to bring ourselves back from the oceans, start to get people out of the most populated cities in a reasonable fashion, and have relocation plans in effect to build where it is sustainable, where you do not have these problems and you have water, but not to overdevelop them, to get development and pure greed out of the way so that people can move there. I would not live in Los Angeles. It is going to be devastated. It is going to be, and mind you, all we hear on the right are people going on television telling us, well, it's not such a bad nuclear. Watch my award-winning documentary, Fatal Fallout. And I did that 7 years ago. Everything in that is true today. We have had hundreds of accidents, and yet these have not reached the level of a Three Mile Island. By the way, Professor Ernest Sternglass and Professor Jay Gould and myself did a scientific paper on the proof that 30,000 deaths occurred in young children in the line of Three Mile Island over the next 2 years because of radiation. And we actually had the original statistics that show that, and then we have a subsequent statistic where it was erased. We got the, actually caught them erasing data. So, and that is, that article, by the way, is up on the website. So anyone who thinks that we can continue mindless exploitation of the environment, denying global warming, denying that we can live anywhere if we have the money and desire, and then take a look at Japan, the type of suffering they're having there now is just almost unimaginable. But they miscalculated. All right? Now I would suggest that all the Pacific Island nations move their population back 2 to 3 miles minimum. And if you're going to build anything now, build it a far greater distance than what you previously had, and build it as if you would have the next one could be a 10. Because we're going to get a 10.
Yeah.
Everything is so unstable now. And so that's my suggestion. Now, most people are going to say, well, that's not possible. And they're correct. That no matter what we write and say about a heads up, nothing will change. They are also correct. We become so detached from the day-to-day reality of our lives. It's like a college, the kids binge drinking now, where the goal was to see who can drink the most drinks before vomiting. And so someone does it, and then they do it every night, without a thought of what it's going to do to the liver, the brain, the kidneys, the lungs. They don't even know about oxidative stress and could care less. So how do you stop a nation from self-destruction? The answer is, you don't. I wish you could, but that doesn't mean you can't get individuals and groups of individuals to say, I'm not going to wait till this bureaucracy, because remember, the Republicans are gridlocked. They're not going to do a damn thing. They're going to stay with the Sean Hannity, Bill Riley, Glenn Beck, global warming's nonsense, and don't interfere with anything. It makes less of a profit for our corporate masters. On the left, you're going to have the corporate Democrats, who are the Clinton Democrats, who are just Republicans in drag, who are going to say, yeah, we're concerned about the environment, but we don't have the reason, and they'll give you every excuse why no one's going to do anything. So right now, because Wall Street owns Washington, and Washington dictates policy from corporate America is not going to put into place what we need to create a sustainable and healthy environment, either for workers or for the environment. But that means then be honest and be aware. Look up and see, all right, what do I have to do in a responsible way to relocate myself where I can have a future in balance with nature? That is the answer I would give. Okay?
Thank you, Gary.
Back in a moment with my commentary and my guest. The liberal class is discovering what happens when you tolerate the intolerant. Let hate speech pollute the airwaves. Let corporations buy your courts and state and federal legislative bodies. Let the Christian religion be manipulated by charlatans to demonize Muslims, gays, and intellectuals. Discredit science and become a source of personal enrichment. Let unions wither under corporate assault. Let social services and public education be stripped of funding. Let Wall Street loot the national treasury with impunity. Let sleazy con artists use lies and deception to carry out unethical sting operations on tottering liberal institutions, and you roll out the welcome mat for fascism. The liberal class has busied itself with the toothless pursuits of inclusiveness, multiculturalism, identity, politics, and tolerance, a word Martin Luther King never used, and forgotten about justice. It naively sought to placate ideological and corporate forces bent on the destruction of the democratic state. The liberal class, like the misguided Democrats in the former Yugoslavia or the hapless aristocrats in the Weimar Republic, invited the wolf into the henhouse. The liberal class forgot that, as Karl Popper wrote in The Open Society and Its Enemies, if we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. Workers in this country paid for their rights by suffering brutal beatings, mass expulsions from company housing and jobs, crippling strikes, targeted assassinations of union leaders, and armed battles with hired gun thugs and state militias. The Rockefellers, the Mellons, the Carnegies, and the Morgans, the Koch brothers' industry, Goldman Sachs, and Walmart of their day never gave a damn about workers. All they cared about was profit. The 8-hour workday, the minimum wage, Social Security, pensions, job safety, paid vacations, retirement benefits, and health insurance were achieved because hundreds of thousands of workers physically fought a system of capitalist exploitation. They rallied around the radicals of the time, like Mother Jones, United Mine Workers President John L. Lewis, and Big Bill Haywood, and his Wobblies, as well as the socialist presidential candidate Eugene Debs. Those who fought to achieve these rights endured tremendous suffering, pain, and deprivation. It is they who made possible our middle class and opened up our democracy. The elite hired goons and criminal militias to evict striking miners from company houses, infiltrated fledging union organizations, and murdered suspected union leaders and sympathizers. Federal marshals and state militias and sheriff's deputies and at times army troops, along with the courts and legislative bodies, were repeatedly used to crush and stymie worker revolts. Striking sugarcane workers were gunned down in Louisiana in 1887. Steel workers were shot to death in 1892 in Homestead, Pennsylvania. Railroad workers in Pullman strike in 1894 were murdered. Coal miners at Ludlow, Colorado in 1914 and at Matawan, West Virginia in 1920 were massacred. Our freedoms and rights were paid for with the courage of their blood. American democracy arose because those consciously locked out of the system put their bodies on the line and demanded justice. The exclusion of the poor and the working class from the systems of power in this country was deliberate. The founding fathers deeply feared popular democracy. They rigged the system in favor of the elite from the start, something that has been largely whitewashed in public schools and by the corporate media that has effectively substituted myth for history. Europe's poor fleeing to America from squalid slums and workhouses in the 17th, 18th centuries were viewed by the privileged as commodities to exploit. Slaves, North Americans, indentured servants, women, and men without property were not represented in the constitutional conventions. And American history, as Howard Zinn illustrated in The People's History of the United States, is one long fight by the marginalized and disenfranchised for dignity and freedom. Those who fought understood the innate cruelty of capitalism. Quote, "When you sell your product, you retain your person," said a tract published in the 1880s during the Lowell mass mill strikes. "But," quote, "when you sell your labor, you sell yourself, losing the rights of free men and becoming vassals of mammoth establishments of a moneyed aristocracy that threatens annihilation to anyone who questions their right to enslave and oppress. Those who work in the mills ought to own them, not have the status of machines ruled by private despots who are entrenching monarchy in principle on democratic soil as they drive downward freedoms and rights, civilization, health, morals, intellectually, in the new commercial feudalism," unquote. As Noam Chomsky points out, the sentiment expressed by the Lowell mill workers predated even Marxism. Quote, "At one time in the United States in the mid-19th century, 150 years ago, working for wage labor was considered not very different from chattel slavery," so said Noam Chomsky. Our consumer society and celebrity culture foster frightening historic amnesia. We chatter mindlessly about something called the American dream, and now that the oligarch elite have reigned control of all the levers of power, and that dream is being exposed as a cruel hoax, we are being shoved back into the cage. There will be hell to pay to get back to where we were. Slick public relations campaigns, the collapse of public education, nearly a third of the country is illiterate or semi-illiterate, and the rise of amoral politicians such as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who posed as liberals while they sold their souls for corporate money, have left us largely defenseless. The last vestiges of unionized workers in the public sector are reduced to protesting in Wisconsin for collective bargaining. In short, the ability to ask employers for decent working conditions. That shows how far the country has deteriorated. And it looks as though even that basic right to ask, as well as raise money through union dues, has been successfully revoked in Madison. The only hope now is more concentrated and militant disruptions to the system of power. The public debate, dominated by corporate-controlled systems of information, ignores the steady impoverishment of the working class and absence of legal and regulatory mechanisms to prevent mounting corporate fraud and abuse. The airways are saturated with corporate apologists. They ask us why public sector employees have benefits, sneeringly called entitlements, which non-unionized middle-class people are denied. This argument is ingenuous. It pits worker against worker in a mad scramble for scraps. And until we again speak in the language of open class warfare, grasping, as those who went before us did, that the rich will always protect themselves at our expense, we are doomed to a 21st century serfdom. The pillars of the liberal establishment, which once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible, have collapsed. The liberal church forgot that heretics exist. It forgot that the scum of society, look at the new Newt Gingriches, always wrapped themselves in the flag and clutched the Christian cross to promote programs that mock the core teachings of Jesus Christ. And for all their years of seminary training and Bible study, those liberal clergy have stood by mutely as televangelists betrayed and exploited the gospel to promote bigotry, hatred, and greed. What was the point, I wonder, of ordination? Did they think the radical message of the gospel was something they would never have to fight for? Schools and universities on their knees for corporate dollars and their boards dominated by hedge fund and investment bank managers have deformed education into the acquisition of narrow vocational skills that serve specialized corporate interests and create classes of drone-like systems managers. They make little attempt to equip students to make moral choices, stand up for civic virtues, and seek a life of meaning. These moral and ethical questions are never even asked. Humanities departments are vanishing as swiftly as the ocean's fish stocks. The electronic and much of the print press has become a shameless mouthpiece for the powerful and a magnet for corporate advertising. It makes little effort to give a platform to those without them cannot be heard, instead diverting such with celebrity meltdowns, lavish lifestyle reports, and gossip. Legitimate news organizations such as NPR and the New York Times are left cringing and apologizing before the beast, right-wing groups that hate liberal news organizations, not because of any bias, but because they center public discussion on verifiable fact. And verifiable fact is not convenient to ideologues whose goal is the harnessing of rage and hatred. In conclusion, artists who once had something to say have retreated into elite enclaves, preoccupying themselves with abstract, self-referential garbage, frivolous entertainment and spectacle. Celebrities working for advertising agencies and publicists provide our daily mini-dramas and flood the airways with lies on behalf of corporate sponsors. The Democratic Party has sold out working men and women for corporate money. It has permitted the state apparatus to be turned over to corporate interest. There is no liberal institution left, the press, labor, culture, public education, the church, or Democratic Party, that makes any effort to hold back the corporate juggernaut. It is up to us. We have tolerated the intolerant. From propaganda outlets such as Fox News to Christian fascists to lunatics in the Republican Party to Wall Street and corporations, and we are paying the price. The only place left for us is on the street. We must occupy state and federal offices. We must foment general strikes. The powerful, with no check left on their greed and criminality, are gorging on money while they busily foreclose our homes, bust the last of our unions, drive up our health care costs, and cement into place a permanent underclass of the broken and the poor. They are slashing our most essential and basic services, including budgets for schools, firefighters, assistance programs for children and the elderly, so we can pay for the fraud they committed when they wiped out $14 trillion of housing wealth, wages, and retirement savings. All we have left is the capacity to say no. And if enough of us say no, if enough of us refuse to cooperate, the despots are in trouble. It was Frederick Douglass in 1857 who said, "Let me give you a word of the philosophy of reforms. The whole history, the progress of human history shows that all concessions made to an august claims have been born of struggle. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet back away from agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand, and it never did, and it never will." Back in a moment. That's Chris Hedges with my guest, coming up, Professor Francis Fox Bibbon. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's go right now to my guest, standing by, Professor Francis Fox Bibbon, Professor of Political Science and Sociology, Graduate Center, City of University of New York. And she's here to talk about what we need to do to unite progressive minds to challenge the financial and political focus that's there now. Nice to have you with us today. Looking at our society as we are, looking at the talking heads on television, listening to them on radio, seeing the movement, what do you see are the principal weaknesses in their strategy, and what do you believe we must do to make a difference?
Well, I don't think that their strategies can proceed without the cooperation of tens of millions of people. We are the workers. the vast number of workers in all industries, in the service sector and in the financial sector. We are also the tens, even hundreds of millions of people who go about our daily life obeying the customs and rules of our society. We go to school. We take our children to school. We pay the rent. We pay the mortgages, or we struggle to pay the mortgages when we can. A society, especially a huge, complicated society like the United States, it depends on intricate systems of cooperation. And those intricate systems of cooperation are also the source of people's power. You know, Gary, I listened to your really wonderful monologue, and I wondered what I would say after it. And because in a certain way you were so comprehensive and so eloquent, as I worried you might leave people without hope. And so I want to make an amendment to your talk, which is this.
Chris Hedges, go ahead, please.
The American politics, social life, and the American economy has always been subject to waves of struggle and change, waves from the bottom and aggressive new initiatives from the top. We never fully win, and they never fully win. But when we are on the move, when great numbers of people are on the move and become angry, defiant, and yet hopeful, we are much more likely to see periods of reform in American society. In fact, American society was born out of such a wave, out of the angry crowds which powered the American Revolution. It's true that there were colonial elites who had their own agenda, which was to improve the terms of trade, for example, and reduce British taxes on trade. But for ordinary people in the colonies, the American Revolution represented the brilliant and glowing idea of radical democracy. And what they fought for was a chance to participate in their own government. They didn't fully win, but they didn't fully lose. And each subsequent great period of reform in the United States, the abolitionist movement, for example, has been a movement against resistance, a movement that didn't fully succeed. After all, after the Civil War and after a brief period of a new birth of freedom, the new coalitions between plantation owners in the South and industrialists in the North reversed some of the victories of the Civil War, but not all of them. And you know, and then there were new waves of struggle from the bottom, the great populist movement of family commercial farmers who were being soaked by the railroads, that also, and the railroads also owned the granaries on which they depended. That great struggle or series of struggles also brought with it reforms. But then when the struggle subsides, the counter movement of the wealthy regains its footing and takes back some or maybe even most of the gains that were won. That's what happened to us in this over the last 40 years. That's what's happened to contemporary American society. There were great movements in the 1930s and in the 1960s. They improved American life. We became somewhat more democratic. The workers won the right to organize and government protection of that right. In the 1930s, we also won the beginning of a social welfare system through the Social Security legislation. We won some regulation over the terms of work in the 1930s. And then in the 1960s, there were new waves of populist struggle, not only over civil rights for African Americans, but also over economic rights for poor people and working people in the 1960s in the cities. Now, the victories that were earned by those movements in the 1930s and 1960s have been the target of a corporate and financial mobilization that began in the 1970s. For at least four decades, they have pummeled at the foundations of democracy in the United States. They have tried to, and they have significantly succeeded, they have tried to roll back the protections that unions won in the, that workers won for unions, really, in the 1930s, so that they are so successful that unionization as a percentage of the workforce has plummeted, and now they are targeting the public sector unions that have survived the assault better than private sector unions. They have pushed back at the social programs that were won beginning in the 1930s and then expanded in the 1960s. They, the kind of greed demonstrated by the American corporate and financial elite is breathtaking. They lobby for bailouts, for subsidies, and then they lobby against any taxation on corporate earnings or even on the wealthy, so that the marginal tax rate in the United States, which was at, you know, in the 1940s and 50s, it was up to 91%. Now it has plummeted. In fact, many corporations don't pay any taxes at all. They don't pay taxes. They fight against any move to tax them in a reasonable and fair way by either the national government or the states. And then when both the national government and the states confront larger and larger debts, the corporations move again and argue that we have to make cuts in spending, cuts in payrolls, cuts in public sector jobs. They set the trap in by refusing and using their political muscle to back up that refusal taxation. And then they say, because there isn't enough money, we have to cut programs for poor mothers and poor children. We have to cut programs for the elderly, for the disabled. We have to cut teachers from the payroll, and on and on and on. Well, I think there's a lesson in American history about what can put a stop to a predatory corporate class that is on a roll. And the lesson is popular resistance movements. And you know what? I think that maybe we're at that point in the sort of cycle of success and defeat where such a movement will again reemerge. I am so struck by how all the groups that I speak with are inspired by the resistance in Madison, Wisconsin, to Governor Walker's attempt to basically strip unions of collective bargaining rights, even while he's also stripping the budget of its social spending and cutting taxes at the same time. But you know, people across the country are looking at Madison, Wisconsin, and seeing Madison, Wisconsin as something like Tahrir Square in Cairo, where the people, having had enough, are getting ready to push back. So, I wanted to tell your audience about a great convening of people who share those views.
We only have 30 seconds left.
I want to tell them about the Left Forum meeting at Pace University this weekend, beginning on March 18th, the evening of March 18th, and urge everybody to come because we have to be with each other and learn from each other about the various strategies for a fight back.
I would agree with that. Thank you very much, Professor Francis Fox Piven, for sharing your points of view.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.